Hey guys, welcome back to the Why Wars Happen History podcast, where you learn about the causes of wars and things like, why did it happen? Was it inevitable? Who was involved? Sometimes I go back hundreds of years just so we can understand what the happened. And if you want to talk more about war, we also have authors, historians, war generals, royalty, actors, filmmakers, a whole bunch of people come on as guests, and we talk about everything about war before, during, and after war. So let's go. Welcome to Why Wars Happen History podcast, where we have narrated war history episodes, and we also have episodes where we sit down with filmmakers, authors, politicians, and historians, and we talk about wars in history. Today's guest, I'm very excited about this. So today's guest is Michael Jones, a military historian, tour guide, and an author of several incredible books, everything pretty much ranging from medieval battles to World War II he's written about. And he is the author of today's book, Bosworth 1485, The Battle That Transformed England. Michael, thank you so much for joining us today.
A big pleasure, Armaline.
Yes. So as I was kind of saying a little bit before we got started here, I am so excited to talk about Bosworth. It's one of those like niche, like if you love Tudors, you've probably heard of the Battle of Bosworth. But yeah, so if you love Tudors, listen to this episode. You're going to love it. I would like to ask you for just a brief overview of what the Battle of Bosworth was and why it was so important.
Yeah, sure. So the Battle of Bosworth was fought on the 22nd of August, 1485. And just to keep it simple, it marked the end of the Wars of the Roses. That's a period of 30 years or so of civil war. And it also marked the beginning of the Tudor dynasty, because the winner at Bosworth, Henry Tudor, becomes Henry VII. And his opponent, the reigning king, Richard III, is killed in battle. So it really is a pivotal moment in terms of our history.
Yes, the beginning of the Tudors. Everybody's favorite. I used to ask people on the show, like way back in the day, you know, what their favorite period of time was. If they could time travel to whatever they focused on, their area of study, or the Tudor era, everyone was like Tudors, Tudors, Tudors. It didn't matter what kind of historian they were. So very popular. And so this is like the craziest thing. There, I don't want to give away like too much, because people really should read this book. It's a really cool book. But can you just give us a little teaser, a little hint of like 500 years, we thought that, oh, the battle took place over here, but you're like, actually?
Well, we have a wonderful, in Leicestershire, we have a wonderful battlefield center for Bosworth. Unfortunately, it is in the wrong place. It was put up in the late 1970s. The county council bought some farmland, and at the time, it was on a hill called Ambion Hill, and if we consider the Tudor version of history, which culminates, of course, with William Shakespeare, the battle takes place, by the time we get to Shakespeare and Shakespeare's Richard III, on Ambion Hill. And that was our first narrative. So if you visited what was described as the battlefield in, say, 1980, everything was arranged around this quite small hill, and the whole battle story was based on that. But over a period of time, a lot of questions have been asked about that narrative. And more recently, there was a debate, and my book, when it first came out, was part of that debate. Lottery, heritage, funding, archaeology. And now we know a lot more. And we know segments of the battle. So we know that the battle took place further south, southwest, about a mile and a half southwest of where the battlefield center is, along a Roman road. And the most exciting thing is that through archaeology, to some extent place name evidence, but really archaeology, we can locate with some degree of certainty where Richard actually died. I take people on battlefield tours, and we look through a gap in the hedge, And I point over in the direction of the field, and I say towards the next hedge. That was where Richard was probably crying out for his horse. So that's pretty neat, isn't it?
Yes, that is amazing. Man, I wish I were in England. I could do that. Come over. Yes, yes. I am planning on going over there, hopefully in the next year. If I do, like, I'm going to hit you up and be like, take me on this tour. I want to do this. So Shakespeare, good old Shakespeare, gave us a lot of our language, but also gave us a lot of misunderstandings about events, let's say, in Kings. So that line, the famous line, "My kingdom for a horse," and that didn't really go down that way, from what we know.
Well, interestingly, there may be some truth in that, to the extent that possibly and probably Richard was unhorsed. He led a charge to try and kill his opponent, and that charge went wrong. Mm-hmm. And then he was driven away. And there's a very interesting source that shows Rhysap Thomas, who was one of Henry Tudor's Welsh followers, fighting Richard. And Richard's horse is rearing up. And you can see the detail is very interesting. The horseshoe has come off. So I don't discount the horse completely. But what's interesting is that Shakespeare is the culmination of Tudor legend, and Shakespeare obviously needed to keep Elizabeth I, the whole Tudor dynasty, on side. Yeah. And the portrayal is basically, it's the judgment story. The way the Tudors increasingly made sense of the battle was it was divine punishment on nasty Richard III, who was guilty of a whole mass of awful crimes. I'm sure you're going to mention one or two of them.
Yes.
And as a result, he has betrayed others. So now on the field of battle, he will be betrayed himself. And I really, classic, in my book, absolutely, no mercy. In my book, I wanted to, this is kind of history told by the winners. And I was fascinated in my book to sort of do history told what might have been told by the losers if they'd had a chance. So rather than nervous Richard, fiddling with his ring and his dagger and having all these nightmares, not even able to have breakfast in the morning, poor guy. Very much on the defensive, very much reacting to events beyond his control. I wanted to portray a dynamic leader with a mission, a sense of, rightly or wrongly, there's a lot of historical debate. But for him, what I put out was he had a strong sense of the legitimacy of his cause, and the core of his army, which was between 2 and 3 times larger than Henry Tudor's, felt the same way. So it's kind of, my story was turning Shakespeare on its head.
Yes, I loved it. And good. I love that idea of, what does the other side have to say about this? And especially with Tudors. And I bring this up on the show a few times where I actually use the Tudors as an example of medieval propaganda, because they're just so, the word escapes me. They're just so the epitome of medieval propaganda, where it's like literally a king set to work, his chroniclers, like, make this guy look as bad as you can and make me look as legitimate as you can.
You've got, you're on it, Emily. I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, we definitely have this, like, you get this almost like chill in your bones when you hear Richard III, and so I do want to bring that up a little bit. But first, I wanted to ask about, so the Battle of Bosworth itself, we have all these different pieces going where we have a larger army and a smaller army. And then we have Lord Stanley kind of hanging back, watching, like, I told Richard I would be there, but who's really going to win? And that's when I'll charge in and help. How close was this battle to going a different way? Let's say, forget Lord Stanley. Forget him charging in.
Okay. Well, we can come back to the Stanleys in a while.
Yes.
To give you an idea of how close it was, so Richard and a force of maybe some 200 mountain knights charged straight at Henry Tudor. And Richard gets close enough to Henry Tudor to kill his standard bearer, William Brandon. So that's within feet of finishing the battle with a win.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah, so close.
We're told by sources, and including Polydor Virgil, who almost certainly spoke to people who were there, that at this point, you know, it's absolutely on a knife edge, and another large knight, John Cheney, rides in the way, blocking Richard's route, so killing Henry Tudor. So it's a matter of feet, and it's a matter of seconds from going the other way. That's how close it is.
Can you imagine? Oh, I can't. I don't even know what history would even look like. That is just...
It would be very different.
Very different. Like, we wouldn't... I don't even know if we'd have the Stuarts, because...
No Tudors.
King James.
No Tudors.
Yeah, so...
Where would we
James
be?
James was... Yeah. Okay, so... And if that didn't happen, how would the colonization of America have happened? Like, just... I don't even know what history would look like. So that is just wild to think about feet. Like, it happened so long ago, but I get the, like, goosebumps, like...
Yeah.
So funny. History seems alive. So we're talking like, so Stanley, was that really true that he hung back and he's like watching the battle, you know, or is that kind of romanticized? Like,
so if you imagine a sports fixture, I don't know what kind of sports you're into, where you've got
none.
Okay. That will be simple. But imagine two teams and then a group of spectators who are reasonably skilled who could join the fixture at any stage. That's what we've got. We've got Richard III's army, and then we've got Henry Tudor's army, and then we have a third army under the Stanleys. Now, my own view is the commander is Sir William Stanley, that's Lord Stanley's younger brother. And this is what the Stanleys had done this. They did this right at the beginning of the Wars of the Roses. William Stanley goes off, joins one side. Lord Stanley attempts to join the other side, but all manner of excuses. Oh, my leg. I'm on my way. And I think exactly.
5 minutes.
Yeah, 10 minutes. Sorry. Traffic's really bad. Gridlock. And they're doing this, you know, they're doing this back in 1459, right at the beginning of the Wars of the Roses, at one battle at Blawheath. I think they're doing exactly the same thing. And Lord Stanley, this is a solemn oath. He says, the first time I actually saw, I met Henry Tudor was on the 24th of August, 2 days after the battle. Mm. So I think we're dealing with Sir William, and actually... Sir William gets written out of the chronicles because later on he rebels against Henry VII and is executed. And then Thomas Lord Stanley is put in his place. So that's a bit complicated, but basically he's kind of, like one of those photographs where one of the people is sort of taken out. So my candidate for this army spectating is that it was the younger brother, Sir William. But anyway, we'll call them the Stanleys.
Mm-hmm. The Stanleys, yeah.
Yeah. So you've got these three armies. And what I think Richard decides to do, the vanguards engage. And then Richard sees an opportunity. He has a clear view of Henry Tudor. Much smaller army. There's no central force with Henry Tudor. It's a large vanguard. And then it's just Henry Tudor. And Richard decides, I'm going to take this guy out. So he charges. So that's what I think was going on. And as I say, it came very close to success, but it was also very risky. because if something went wrong and something did go wrong, the Stanley Force can intervene. So,
yes.
So it was a very bold and courageous, I'm using positive words, but also very risky.
Yeah.
You get a flavor of that. So, yeah. I don't want to complicate things too much with the Stanleys, because I'll tell you this, people at the time had no idea what their family was up to. So if you're feeling confused, you can join the 15th century club. Yeah, there's one.
Perfect.
2 years earlier, when Richard has just taken the throne, so there's an earlier rebellion called Buckingham's Rebellion. There's a Stanley Force moving around in Lancashire, and one writer says, there's a Stanley Force moving around, but what they're up to, I haven't the faintest idea. And I think that kind of sums it up with that lot.
Love it, love it. So we can all rest easy. We're not supposed to understand everything about this. Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, that's pretty cool. And for fans of, I'm going to bring it up, fans of Game of Thrones and fans of Tudors will see the connection or have seen the connection. It's almost comical how much the Wars of the Roses and all the characters and the events and everything are actually in Game of Thrones.
Sure.
Where people are going, oh, Sir William, the Lord Stanley is like, okay, Stannis, you know, and then you have the Lannisters in Game of Thrones are the Lancasters, right? And the Starks are the Yorks. And then you have the entire map of Game of Thrones. The whole land world is really just Britain turned on its side. If you turn Britain side, that's map.
I know people have really gone to town on this, because undoubtedly the Wars of the Roses was an influence, but at the same time, it's kind of taken on a life of its own. I think the way Game of Thrones begins with that kind of very trusting appearance at a hostile court, George R. R. Martin is portraying a more gullible Richard, because in 1483, Richard takes the throne rather than being ambushed by his opponents. I'd like to stick up for Richard here, that he was the one when his brother Edward IV died, who was under threat, he was smart and resourceful. So I'm just putting that.
That's true. He did. He's kind of like, I mean, it's the king, it's the throne, and you're like, cool, I get to be the king, but also very dangerous. And so he does get some credit there for going, I'll be the king while the princes are in the tower.
You brought them out.
Yes, yes, little flash of what's to come.
What's to come?
You can't talk about Richard III and all this stuff without mentioning the princes in the tower. And just for our listeners who might not know what that is, can you just give us a little overview of what the princes in the tower are? I know it's a big one, but just, you know.
Yeah, so the princes in the tower, they're two boys. They're the two sons of Edward IV, the previous king, Richard's older brother. So these two boys, the oldest of the two is actually recognized. He isn't crowned, but he's recognized as Edward V, and his younger brother is named Richard. So Richard, Duke of Gloucester, the future Richard III, he's their uncle. So Edward V should, the expectation of many in April 1483, when Edward IV dies, he should have gone on to become king, to be crowned. But instead, over a period of time, I'm not going to go into all the detail, but
yeah, sure, it's a lot.
A Stony Stratford, Richard gets hold of Edward V, and then a bit later on, he gets hold of his brother. They go into the tower, and they are not seen again. So that's the basic background to it.
And so, okay, so there's so much debate. That is like the ultimate, well, at least for me, that is the ultimate medieval debate. Did Richard III kill the princes in the tower so that he could remain the king? And there's lots of heated debate on that. So
it hasn't stopped. And I think in 100 years' time, it probably will still be going on.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So we're going to debate it today. We're just going to throw it out there that it's a debate.
Sure.
One of the things I'm so interested in, fingers crossed, probably not going to happen, but is the DNA testing where we found bones that we believe that might belong to those two princes. And we want to DNA test them to go, well, we could DNA test them to confirm, and then we can extrapolate how they died and all that. But there's this block to, or at least like Queen Elizabeth II was like, I don't want to just let them rest. We don't want a DNA test. But King Charles, I think, has said that he's up for it. So what's the deal? Why are we not testing that? Do you know? Who knows?
I'm not privy to his inner thoughts, sadly.
Yes.
I do know that he is far more favorably disposed to the bones being tested. So again, to clarify this for your readers, that in the reign of Charles II, when they were doing some renovation work on the tower, they found the bones under a staircase. They were examined in the 1930s. That examination was interesting, but also left a certain amount to be desired. And so we have this urn in Westminster Abbey that might not hold their remains. And that's why DNA testing is so important. It was the clincher when found the remains of poor Richard himself in the car park and
in a parking lot.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Which really resonated with the British public, to be stuck in a car park for more than 500 years.
Poor guy. I didn't think about it.
Poor guy.
That was really funny. Poor guy.
But it's a bit like with the Romanovs when the whole debate about Anastasia and Anna Anderson, that was finally sorted out by DNA. So it would be wonderful if this could happen. Yeah.
Yes. And for anybody interested, I believe there is like this petition and this like organization. I think it's called the Two Princes Project. I might be getting that wrong. But if you Google it, there is like a whole project about trying to get the required approvals from Westminster Abbey and the king and everything. And I don't know how close they are, but I'm just going to encourage hordes of people to go knock down doors and try to get this DNA testing done. Because, oh my God, that would, honestly, it probably would continue the debate in a different way about, well, what does it really mean? And how did they die? But it would be like a big puzzle piece. So,
sure, definitely. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And going back just a little bit to the reputation of Richard, this is one of my favorite subjects too. I don't know if you can tell, I love talking about Richard's reputation. I don't know why. But is there anything that you came across that was like, so obviously a lot of propaganda. Was there something that was just totally outlandish that was said about him, just crazy, that maybe most people don't know about that was said?
We're finding new things about him all the time, some small, some bigger. If we start with, go back to Shakespeare again, you know, when the winter of our discontent, the first thing he's up to is he's plotting the murder of another of his brothers, George Duke Clarence, who will have the most wonderful death in that butt of Malmsey wine.
That's right.
And so he's up to no good from the very beginning. And, you know, sort of because he's aiming for the throne, he wants to get his brother, who's older than him, out of the way. How?
He's just unhinged murderer all around.
He's a psycho killer, absolutely, in Shakespeare's eye. But the interesting thing is that we have a source that predates the Tudors, Dominic Mancini. He was an Italian who was in London at around the time Edward IV died, for about 6 months, so late 1482 to the summer of 1483. And he's a sort of reflection of a variety of sources, but what he says was that Richard, far from plotting the murder of his brother, was distraught, feared, blamed the death on the Woodville family, that's the family of Edward IV's queen, felt that he was next, so here we're getting the whole resonance of Game of Thrones coming in, retreated to his strongholds in the north, and came to court more rarely. And when I was researching, I found some very interesting material in the Durham records that kind of bore that out. So we're finding snippets all the time, and some of these snippets portray a more nuanced personality. And some of them go against the grain, very much go against the grain of the Tudor picture.
Yes, I love that. I don't think that he was just like a raging psychopath killer. It has the ring of like not quite true. He's a real person. He would have felt things and
nuances, as you said. Absolutely. And, respected. He, during the second part of his brother's reign, he binds together the north of England. Now, that was a rough, tough area to get a handle on.
And the north of England, yeah.
Yeah, you get then and now, yep. And he wins people's respect by a variety. He's a military leader who'll win back Berwick, that was given away at the beginning of the Wars of the Roses. He gets a lot of respect for that. He shows, both as Duke and King, he shows very fair justice and gets a lot of respect for that. One could go on and on, but the interesting thing about him and why he's effective in 1483 was that he's a shrewd political operator and also commands a lot of loyalty. And he's also, a man of real piety and also very strongly influenced by chivalry. So these are features of him that don't crop up very much in the Tudor picture, but I think are very important in terms of understanding both him and the battle.
Yes, and I could be totally mixing up my king portraits here, but isn't there a painting of him with his like fingers, like almost like a Mr. Burns style, like fingers together? I could be totally thinking of another king.
Well, there's one picture where he's nervously pulling at a ring or fiddling with a dagger. Of course. Some of these pictures were doctored, adding a hump, for example. We can show by X-ray examination of that picture that it was added later just to make him more nasty.
That's crazy. And even like down to the colors, like it's very subtle, but there seems to be like a shade of dark over that portrait. Like it's not bright and like here's this awesome king. It's you get this sense of like coldness when you look at that photo or the painting. And I wonder if, I don't know if anything was done after that to that, but that's just my take on it.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of influenced. Yeah. It's the power of hindsight for better or for worse. Very powerful to find his remains and for his remains to be reburied. Because we're starting to step away from that Shakespearean portrait of him. And of course, there was a very different reconstruction of his face that was done as a result of the fine. So we're starting to move away from the angst-ridden kind of finger-twiddling and getting something, I'd say, more complex.
And am I crazy, but does he, the new, like, construction of his face, does it look like, what's his name, like, what's Lord Farquhar in Shrek, the I'm trying to think of what his name is. The Shrek Prince guy. He looks like the new face of Richard III. I swear to God, Google it. It's the craziest thing.
I'll check that out later.
It's like, oh my God. Like, I wonder if they based it off of that. I don't know the timeline here. But yeah,
I'll be very cautious going down that route before I knew about it. So.
Yeah, seriously. It's one of those, like, you know, conspiracy things or something, but look it up. It's so weird.
Okay.
Okay. So hypothetically here, if Richard had won Bosworth, what kinds of things do you think he would say about Henry Tudor in propaganda? How do you think he would paint him?
That's an interesting question.
No, it's kind of out there.
Yeah. I mean, well, Henry Tudor, it's an interesting one. And he spent most of his life as an exile or a fugitive. So he was in Brittany, which at that time was a semi-independent power within France. And he was in Brittany for about 12 years, and then he was sheltered by the French. And one of the things, I mean, this is my own sense, that with a bit of dark humor at the Yorkist court, was that he wasn't seen as a great martial figure. Edward IV tries to get hold of Henry Tudor because he's a potential claimant. He has a Lancastrian blood link via his mother, Margaret Beaufort. This is complicated because the Beauforts are of royal blood, but they've been barred from the throne. But if you're barred, you can get unbarred. Edward IV is keeping an eye on him. And in 1476, he nearly gets him out of Brittany. But the Breton Duke is ill. All this goes on. And then Henry goes down with this violent fit of stomach cramps. And while this chaos is happening with his stomach cramps, the Breton Duke kind of recovers and sends a fast messenger saying, no, it's all a mistake. Bring him back. But this idea of the stomach cramps, which is referred to again by Polydor Virgil and shortly before the invasion, and then in Buckingham's rebellion, this rebellion against Richard in 1483 is supposed to be supported by Henry Tudor. Henry Tudor, his small fleet is dispersed by a storm, but he kind of appears off the coast, probably of Dorset. And sends a boat to kind of have a look, and then just decides, I'm out of here. And the picture is starting to emerge here. And during this campaign, so he lands in Wales and then marches into England. And then for at least a day, he gets lost and he loses his army. Now, I think that if Richard had won, that there'd be some rather wry humor, because I think the thing, this is my own take in terms of the book, I think the thing that angered Richard was seeing Henry Tudor about a mile back from his main body of troops, kind of so he could make a run for it if things weren't going very well. And if you kind of put everything I'm saying together, I think from Richard's point of view, he saw him as a man who was not up to the mark in terms of courage. In terms of fairness, it could also be said that he's shown a lot of courage in showing up at all with that small army. But I'm not trying to be even-handed. I'm trying to answer your question, which is how Richard and the Yorkist victors. So I think they'd have taken the piss out of Henry Tudor, to be blunt.
Yeah. Lots of interesting, juicy things that they could have said. I feel even way more than they could have said than they did say about Richard. There's a lot of stuff. Ooh.
There was quite a lot they said about Richard.
Yeah.
I mean, basically, once you've won and you've killed your opponent and you're on the throne, you know, you've got
fair game.
You've got a lot of ammo you can start playing with.
Yeah. Yeah, that is so. Okay, so before we go, I do want to ask a little bit about the mothers. the Margaret Beaufort has been, she pops up a lot in Henry's sort of journey to becoming king. Was she really that like super, almost like helicopter mom, deeply involved in his life?
Helicopter mom, I love it. This is a great American phrase, isn't it? I tell you, she was so active that if she'd had access to a helicopter, she'd have been over that battlefield. I'm absolutely sure of it. But the thing is that they're very, very close after Henry wins, and she, as King's mother, she's the power behind the throne. But the thing to stress is that, firstly, when Henry was growing up, that he separated from his mother, and Henry, again, for your listeners, viewers, he's an only child, and he's granted to the idea of wardship. He's basically given to one of Edward IV's chief followers, William Lord Herbert. So Henry is taken away from his mother to Raglan Castle in Wales. That's where he's brought up. They're briefly reunited, and then Henry's blown away. He's trying to get to France with his uncle Jasper Tudor. He ends up in Brittany. So for most of his life, mom and son are separated. And it's really, there's a retrospective. I mean, she's obviously, you know, they're in touch. We know that in Richard's reign, she's a conspirator. She's taking a lot of risks on his behalf. And we also know that late in Edward IV's reign, and perhaps earlier, she's trying to broker a deal with the king to get her son back. So props to her.
Yeah.
She's really doing her best. But I think at the same time, one has to say that rather than being a helicopter mom, she's an absent mom trying to do her best in difficult circumstances. But
yeah,
they have a very, very close bond, and she plays a part in the victory.
Yeah, she was like very, very for it. Like, this is going to happen. Let's do this. And contrasting that with Richard's mom, Cecily Neville. So I'm like, I always say it wrong. I don't know. Maybe it's my bias. I always say it wrong. So she was kind of like,
she'd put you right very quickly.
Yeah. So she was very much like,
she was
afraid of what was going to happen and knew very well what the stakes were and everything. Happened to her? Did she die before her son was killed in battle?
No. Years afterwards. Okay. Now, again, the Tudor legend. You have Margaret Beaufort, a kind of helicopter mom. I do enjoy that phrase. Where Cecily Neville is slandered by nasty Richard, who even says that his mother might have committed adultery, and that big brother Edward wasn't legitimate, which, you know, according to the Tudors, is totally Richard's invention. And if we go back to Dominic Mancini, he tells us that it was Cecily herself who said that. But let's not worry about that. and then, famously, you know, Cecily curses Richard. So, you know, so in our modern era of psychoanalysis, we can have a lot of fun with that. But again, in my book, I didn't buy that sequence of events. And if I just make one of many points I could make, but as Richard is preparing to meet Henry Tudor in battle, he goes up to Nottingham Castle. And on the way, he stops off where Cecily is at Berkhamsted Castle. That's where she lives. That's where she will die in 1495, 10 years after the battle. So rather than being cursed by his mother, Richard is asking for her blessing.
Lovely. That's nice. Okay.
Yes, it is.
A couple questions left. Yes, it is actually very nice. And so I prefer that version. And it sounds more true than cursing her son. Okay, so other than the princes in the tower, other than Richard's reputation, are there any topics or questions around this era of like Wars of the Roses, Bosworth, that are highly debated today still?
Well, the princes in the tower is the high octane topic that fascinates us. And what I would like to say about this is that it's kind of like a Kafka-esque court of justice that it keeps rescheduling and rescheduling and rescheduling. But if we imagine a scenario, and it's just a scenario where Richard believes that he has a right to be king, and as a result does not initially want to kill the princes. This is the argument I put forward in Bosworth. And then there is an attempt to rescue the princes, and I was the first historian to put that on the map.
That
at this point, he has to balance the risk, if he keeps them alive, again, you know, the risk to his dynasty, and that's the most important thing. And at this point, if we step back and look at historical precedent, I'd mention two. So the first is when Henry Bolingbroke, the future Henry IV, lands in England in 1399. He becomes king. He'll become Henry IV. He deposes the reigning king, Richard II, doesn't have him killed. But when there's the first rising that tries to put him back on the throne, he is killed. And the second thing I'd mention is that late in Henry VIII's reign, when there is another dynastic threat by the Poole family, these are descendants through the female line of Richard's brother, George, Duke of Clarence. He has the elderly Countess of Salisbury, Margaret Poole, executed, her son executed. And the key thing is her grandson is also 12, the same age as Edward V. He's put in the tower, never seen again. And yet we have books and books and tons of attention on one prince in the tower and none on the other. So I think that it was, whatever we think, and there are a variety of opinions, that the reality was that the biggest and most important thing for a medieval aristocrat or ruler was safeguarding what was called the live load, the livelihood, the inheritance. And if it's a king, it's the dynasty. And if you muck that up, that's the worst thing.
Yes, yes. So these would be what you guys all discuss if I put a bunch of Tudor historians in a room for 12 hours. It would all end in this kind of debate and discussion.
Well, that would be a very optimistic. A key thing is plenty of food and alcohol, and I'm sure everyone, rather like George Duke Clarence, you know, we'd roll with it as Oasis.
I would pay to see it. I would pay to see that those discussions. And my last question is, are there any other books you're working on in the future that we can see after this?
Yeah. So I've done a book on the Black Prince. Do look out for that. That's also brought out in the States as well as in the UK. And that was a wonderful thing to do. And again, you know, trying to reevaluate the reputation. And what I'm working on at the moment is the end of the Hundred Years' War. So there's going to be a lot there on Joan of Arc, and you look at Joan of Arc, and how it all goes wrong. And the bigger question is, in that, is why we keep fighting losing wars. So kind of topical, eh?
Yes, very topical. Interesting. Ooh, God, the Black Prince too in the Hundred Years. I don't even know which one I would pick to read first. That's really interesting.
Well, the Black Prince is out, so go to it.
Okay, that's the first one that I'm going to read. That is so interesting. Okay.
I loved writing that book. I really did. Do check it out, Emily. Yeah.
And you can get it on Amazon, just like this one, Bosworth. You can get it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, basically anywhere that you find books. Okay. Yes. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show and answering all of these questions. I loved talking with you. Michael Jones, author of Bosworth 1485, The Battle That Transformed England, and author of a lot of other books too. Thank you for being here.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Bye.